All right, welcome. We'll go ahead and get start the Tax Relief for Pollution Control Property Advisory Committee. And we will look at the committee members that are here, or maybe it's easier to look at the ones that are not here. Tell you what, those of you that are on the phone that are members, if you'll please let us know who's on the phone. Any committee members on the phone?
Yeah, Mike Nassie's on the phone. Bob, I can barely hear you, though.
I'm speaking of Mike. Is that better?
That's better, and I hear Paul as well.
Okay. Any other members on the phone?
Mike Ford's on the call.
Okay.
Chris Zielinski representing DMA.
Okay. Am I loose? So we're missing Paul.
Good morning. This is Charles Allred.
Hey, Charles. Glad you could join us.
Hey.
Just going through the roll right quick. I think Paul will probably call in.
We can't hear you, Bob.
Can we? You can step back? Okay, the guy's working on it. Oh, I'm much closer than I usually am. Now, I know it's got to be better, but I have to eat it the whole time? Okay.
That's better.
Okay. Well, yeah. All right. Okay. I'll comply. I might do that. Sorry for the slow start, guys. My records looks like Paul Kuhn is the only one missing. It's not in attendance.
Bob, this is Paul Kuhn here.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. I think everyone is on, from what I can tell. As usual, I'll just state the policy for the committee is we welcome input from the public. And especially those of you that are online, we'll try to pause often to allow certain comments or any comments that you think are relevant. And any general comments before we start the committee meeting? All right, no general comments. We'll jump right in if we can get an update on HRSGS. Don?
Good morning. My name is Don Redmond. I'm with the TCEQ Environmental Law Division. There's been no change in the status of the HRSGS cases since your last meeting. Just to update you, petitions for review have been submitted to the Texas Supreme Court in both the group of Tier 3 cases from the El Paso Court of Appeals and the Tier 4 cases from the Austin Court of Appeals. There have been several rounds of briefing, and I believe there's one more round of briefing on both sets of cases, and so that's where we are today.
All right, thank you. I know better than to ask if you can predict when these will be heard. So
I really couldn't predict. They may schedule it for argument, which could extend any of their ultimate decisions.
Right. Okay. Thanks for that update. As you know, we have an ongoing interest in this because it could have broader impact. Thank you. Okay, I get to the main item of the agenda, which is our triennial review. We started this back in April or even before. The staff advised us. In fact, would it be appropriate to, up since it's been, 5 months, does any staff want to give us a remind us of what the timeline is on the triennial review?
Good morning. I'm Shelley Nike with TCEQ. The timeline we talked about before was, I guess, the process being if you want to submit to us a recommendation for any changes to the table. The last time you did it, you had no changes, and we've been informed by our general counsel they would like us to actually, write a memo if you had no recommended changes and take that to the commission to make sure that they agree with that, our decision on that. Otherwise, if you want to initiate a rulemaking, because you do have recommended changes, you want to suggest to us that we initiate a rulemaking to change the table, our typical rulemaking timeline is approximately 18 months from start to finish. So to target a 2020 adoption for that rule, we would probably need a recommendation by early next year.
Okay. Thanks, Shelley. With that, we'll jump into this agenda item. And back in April, or even before I started warning the industry groups that I'm affiliated with, that this is coming up, so soliciting ideas, any input. So I got several inputs, had people talking to me, and especially one that put a little more effort into it. So I thought it's worth, and also, you'll recall that DCQ staff provided us with a list of Tier 2 and Tier 3 application stats, and that's the basis of what this draft recommendation was from, is my understanding. So, and I did peruse it before I sent it in. I didn't just take whatever somebody sent to me, so it looked at least reasonable for discussion. So that's what I have done, and the property is just in alphabetical order, and in order of Tier 2 and Tier 3. You'll notice the recommendations for Tier 1 additions, only Tier 2 items, and there are a number of also listed are the ones that were not recommended to be added to Tier 1, and these are listed just so you'll know that they were reviewed. So, and if there are any, I did get a comment back on one that was on the not add, and that's carbon capture. So if we want to hear back from anyone else, at this point I'm going to just going to step back and since I reviewed it, probably more detail than a lot of you have, I just want to give you time to speak on it.
Well, Bob, I can take up a discussion of the carbon capture item if you'd like to do that first.
That's fine. Go ahead.
You bet. Everybody, this is Mike Nassy, and I apologize to Bob already because I had I've been a little bit unavailable to comment about what should be added and should not be added. And I'm guessing, is Greg, are you present at the meeting there?
I am.
Okay, great. So I think Greg made an accurate statement, which is that there isn't an anticipation of a lot of projects coming down the pike. So this isn't something that we're trying to position for actual known projects. But I do think it's just a straightforward application of the program consistent with a prior resolution of the committee that we would recommend that carbon capture equipment be on Tier 1. Just a quick piece of history for everybody. And I apologize, I didn't send this out in advance, but we had a recommendation that we issued formally, Bob, I think it was April 24th of 2015. At that advisory committee meeting, we had a unanimously adopted recommendation to recommend to the commission that they view carbon capture equipment installed at an existing power plant as having an adequate environmental rule in place to provide a basis for eligibility of CCUS equipment for a positive use determination. So there's two ways. Go ahead, Bob.
I was going to say, I would add, I think that was a relatively narrow recommendation, as I recall. And it's been a while since I've looked at it, but it could have been much broader, and it was pretty narrow.
It could have been broader, and we narrowed it just to make it specific to the existing power plant issue. But I do agree that right now the state of the law is that there is already BACT for what we call anyway sources that have to have federal permits for other reasons whenever they go through a modification process. They do actually have to evaluate for greenhouse gas BACT. So it is
you know, for a significant component of the regulated community, already a regulated pollutant and ongoing permitting issue. But independent of that, in the power sector, there is regulations that have been promulgated under 111B as in boy and 111D as in dog. The 111B as in boy rule applies to new and modified sources. It is still in place and was never stayed. The 111B as in boy, 111D as in dog rule is what's commonly known as the Clean Power Plan. It was stayed by the Supreme Court. The EPA has announced that its intentions are to repeal and replace it. It has proposed the Affordable Clean Energy, or ACE, rule. That ACE rule would continue to regulate carbon dioxide from existing power plants. It does it in a different way by limiting the evaluation of what might be achievable to an inside-the-fence evaluation. And, you know, I think the basic bottom line is that I'd like us to talk about and hear staff's thoughts about, because, you know, maybe they've thought about this already, and I don't want to presume to be the only one who cares about this. There are others on the committee that I would think care about it. Is that if this administration has chosen the path of not just repealing the Clean Power Plan and revisiting the endangerment rule. In fact, they've chosen to replace the Clean Power Plan with a regulation, so there might be some debate about whether that regulation does enough, but in terms of this program, there will be, upon the culmination of that rule, of that regulatory docket, a regulation in place regulating carbon dioxide at both new and existing facilities. And so any capture device, any device that's installed that would capture carbon dioxide at one of those facilities would seemingly be Tier 1 equipment, because it would be, in that case, probably exceeding the regulation. But still, I don't think there could be a debate about whether there's a regulatory driver. So for the power sector, I think that is a legitimate question. I am not taking up the much larger question of whether efficiency controls should be eligible. I'm sorry, efficiency improvements. I'm talking about just carbon capture, because Greg teed up the issue quite well in his document, because it was something that we obviously had seen here in Texas, because we have the largest carbon capture project in the world. And we're not sure how many more are going to come down. And Greg, I don't want to speak for you, but your comment was basically, don't know of anybody who's proposing to do it, so I'm not sure that's critical to add it at this time. It wasn't a disagreement about eligibility. It was really just one of practical need. Right, Greg?
That's correct.
So I'll just set up and open for comments and questions about the topic generally, and certainly would welcome staff's input. Bob, I'll leave it to you about how to moderate that discussion.
I'm correctly reading body language. I thought Cyrus had a comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything Mike has said factually, but the other issue is as we know, some of the carbon capture proposals in the past, and honestly, those haven't really gone forward, but I'm thinking of the Summit one, were also about using carbon injection to create a byproduct for oil and gas exploration. And so that's a case where there'd be a something you'd get money. You know, you would be regulating carbon dioxide, but at the same time, there would be a product. And so that's one of the issues at the NRG facility. I think that's not the case, so it wasn't really an issue. So that, I mean, if we were to do it, I'd want some language in there that said, but if the intent was to recover a product, then it would need to go through the tier three or something like that.
Well, I think one way to manage that that distinction, to be clear, that Petronova is a project where they obviously spent a significant amount of money to capture carbon dioxide, and they did not seek any Prop 2 treatment, any pollution control property treatment, after the carbon dioxide left the facility. And there's a significant investment in the pipeline and in the injection and pressurization systems that are, you know, admittedly, you know, one could argue they are still part of the pollution control process, but that's not what I'm proposing here. What I'm saying is everything that's at a power plant that captures carbon dioxide is reducing an emission that is a regulated pollutant under the Clean Air Act right now. And that question about whether or not, you know, the entire system all the way to the wellhead really is where I think we deal with the issue of whether or not it's used in enhanced oil recovery. I mean, I really think of it as very similar, for example, to any other pollution control process. Let's just take fly ash, where we capture in our particulate control a significant amount of material. Many instances over the decades involve the disposal of that material, but people took, you know, innovative steps to make that material more marketable, and they've been able to actually recycle. And I don't think, as a committee, that we should take the position that if people figure out a way to make use of something that is a byproduct of a capture process, that changes their eligibility for pollution control property treatment of the actual capture equipment. It doesn't seem consistent with the statutory purpose here. I totally get that if you go out into the world and you say, hey, the injection system, the pipeline, all that which converts that, you know, that waste into a product, that is a different story, and I'm not trying to cross that bridge. I'm just trying to say that the capture aspects, regardless of what one does with CO2 after it leaves the plant, that is a pollutant being captured. Its conversion into a commodity is a capital-intensive process that includes a bunch of other equipment. But I think the way to deal with the EOR, enhanced oil recovery, hypothetical that Cyrus has pointed out, which is very legitimate because that's actually what happened at Petronova too. But again, the separation at Petronova, as I understand it, is they, you know, NRG just didn't pursue an exemption outside the fence of the facility because it was basically recognizing that was more of a product conversion process than it was a pollution reduction process. I could make arguments that unless you actually sequester it, unless you actually inject it and work to keep it downhole, that is pollution control, but I'm not trying to cross that bridge. I'm not making that argument, nor would I, because there's no project to advocate. This is just a straight-up equipment, bolt-on equipment that captures carbon dioxide. Shouldn't it be Tier 1?
Thanks for clarifying. Any other comments on this item? No comments. All right, so currently we have it on the not add list, and Mike, am I to interpret that you're proposing to add it to the Tier 1 list, and you will propose some language where currently there is none in that category?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'll work with Greg to write it. We're going to take this list up for recommendation. It sounded to me, what do you envision being the timing that during our next meeting we make our set of recommendations?
That could be. It's very, very possible. Shelley is nodding her head. So I know you didn't see that, Mike. But it could be we might need to have an extra meeting. If your deadline is for us to have it, or you prefer us to have it for the first part of next year, right.
Hello. Okay. So the recommendation you submit, it wouldn't immediately become effective. We would have to initiate a rulemaking based on that recommendation. So it wouldn't become effective till 2020.
But what date? You said early 2019 we have to give it to you. What's early? Is that February or March or?
First quarter. Y'all meet quarterly, so ideally by your first quarter meeting in 2019.
Okay. But to be safe, by the end of the year would be certainly good. But okay, we'll shoot for the end of the year and realize we got a little cushion in the first.
Sure, because again, we would take that recommendation and then evaluate it, and
right,
then initiate a rulemaking and propose potential changes. So it is a long process.
All right, thank you. Any other? Go ahead, Lloyd.
Mike, may I, this is Lloyd Graham, may I ask you a question, please?
Yeah, you bet.
You know my simple mind. And when I think about this bolt-on equipment that captures something that turns into a commercial product that generates profit, how does that juxtapose against a Herjic? Are we creating a rule or recommending a rule that has some effect on this case that's going in front of court? You're the lawyer here, so I thought I'd get your read.
Yeah, I mean, I am sensitive to anything that could be implicated or create an argument in an ongoing litigation. I think we just want to be really, like we were when we made the recommendation in 2015, really narrow, right, and talk about the specific issue. The simple fact is that is a regulated air pollutant. It is capturing it. The Herjic debate is a process change that results in less production of a pollutant per unit of energy produced. It is almost the perfect example of, you know, efficiency-based pollution control, which is a different topic that we should definitely as a committee be grappling with, because I know Ron, before he retired, was talking about how we're entering into a new age of pollution control, and it makes these types of decisions so much more important. So I think that is a bigger topic. The Herjics trigger a whole series of questions about whether in the future, if most of our pollution control is going to be coming from efficiency improvements, how is this exemption going to play in, and how is the staff going to navigate it without overworking itself? But totally different is the question of you take a pollutant that is regulated, you capture it. I'm not aware of us ever in the program, and I'd like to hear staff's opinion, of going back and revisiting or reducing the percentage off of a pollution control project when the people figured out a way to take that pollutant after it was captured and off-site it was converted into a product, whether it was brick making or whatever. I've never heard us actually make that, this, you know, curtailment, and so I don't think we should start with carbon dioxide. I just think the natural way to respond to your question and to the concern but the point that Cyrus made is that if somebody does invest in that infrastructure outside the fence to turn that carbon dioxide into a product, that equipment is a different ball game. And we're not talking about that. We're just talking about the stuff to keep it from being emitted, not the actual transportation. Because I can tell you, at the fence line of a power plant, it ain't a product. It is not ready. It's not in the right place. It's not at the right compression. It's, you know, it's not going to be a product until, you know, somebody invests hundreds of millions of dollars to move it. And so I just think it's a different situation. I really do think it's much more analogous to fly ash, for example, or something else that really was a pollutant. And if somebody gets innovative and figures out a way downstream to convert it, then they're free to do that. But that doesn't relate to the on-site capture.
You know, just a clarification for people that don't remember what the fly ash he's talking about. It's a very good additive to concrete that keeps it from separating from the aggregate. In fact, I believe the highway department requires like 24% fly ash in their cement you know, it's that good a product. But I don't know how much money they make off of it. I don't think it's really it helps pay for the disposal of the fly ash, but I don't think it actually makes them a lot of profit.
Right. I think we actually put a pencil to that one time and felt pretty comfortable that there was no net because of the capital and O&M expense associated with that control equipment, because that's really what it comes back to, Lloyd, to answer your very straightforward question, is the investment they're making is extraordinary, and, you know, whatever analysis of how they might make the economics work outside defense of the facility doesn't play into the fact that that's a pollutant no different than any other, that we acknowledge that if they're going to make a big capital expense and have ongoing O&M, we're going to recognize that that's pollution control.
So, Mike, once again, if I'm hearing you correctly, as with fly ash, which used to be given away if you just come haul it off, County and Fayette used thousands and thousands of yards of it to build roads. If it's the carbon dioxide is going outside the fence and going to be turned into something, so as a clay line, a demarcation at the fence, carbon dioxide's outside the fence, herds are inside the fence. Thank you.
I'd say it a little differently. I appreciate your clarification there. That's one way of looking at it. I would just say that Herzigs are a process that nets a reduction in pollutant per unit of energy produced. That is an efficiency project, right? Versus somebody having to bolt on a capture device that doesn't. Not only is it not an efficiency event, it's actually extremely inefficient because it has a huge energy penalty to run the machine to capture it. So it's much more like a baghouse. It's a baghouse / scrubber / bolt-on pollution control piece of equipment. It's not an efficiency improvement. Efficiency improvements are certainly something we need to grapple with as a committee, but that's not what I'm proposing to resolve to add to Tier 1. It's just to recognize that in an age where the EPA is going to keep on regulating carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act, we need to recognize that actual capture technologies should be Tier 1.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Lloyd. Thank you. I trust it's clear that my concern is not the carbon dioxide. My concern is the Herzigs.
Yeah, no, I get it.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Oh, this is Roland Bieber. Question, what is the difference inside the fence line if you're going to capture it and as a pollutant and do away with it, or if you're going to capture it as a pollutant and put it in a pipeline to be sent to the oil field? What's the difference? What's the difference in the mechanism inside the fence line?
All the technologies vary a little bit, but the prime technology that's being utilized, at least the one that was at Petronova, is an amine process. So they basically cool the flue gas, interface it with a salt, a product like an amine. Amine binds to the CO2, it falls out. The question you're asking really goes to how is that CO2 gas stream prepared, right? It has to be cleaned and compressed just to be able to be moved in that pipeline. The cleaning level and the compression level may vary a little bit depending on what the end use is, but there's so few pure disposal projects. The ones that have been deployed, one called the Mountaineer Project by AEP back east, it proved to be extremely expensive. But they still had to go through a cleanup and compression process because they need to be able to have that CO2 be safe to transport in a pipe, right? Because if it's going to be actually, it doesn't count if you just capture it, Roland, to your point. You have to actually sequester it, right? So you either need to shove it in a hole in a deep saline aquifer, or you need to shove it in a reservoir and in an EOR project, which can help enhance oil recovery, but it's still going to be sequestered in the pore space below. Moving it requires compression, and moving it safely requires cleanup. In both instances, you're going to have to do those steps. The capital equipment will be almost the same. I will not try to tell you, though, that you might not clean it up more or do different things depending on whether it was going to get used in an oil field versus a saline aquifer. But the big capital expense is present. I don't think we have anybody either on the call or on the committee that has been involved in both kinds of projects, but I think it's fair to say that is, based on the current capture technologies, what happens in both instances. Does that answer your question, Roland?
Yeah, we had a situation at one of the refineries in Port Arthur where a company came in. It was part of a government project, and I think they spent about $400 million overall to capture the CO2. They made an application to TCEQ, and at the time it was denied. We, in putting it on the roll, looked at the pollution capture, and we also looked at the enterprise on the end where they were selling the CO2, and basically did capitalize that income stream and put it on for I don't forget what, but it was a very small part of the initial investment. And that's why I feel a little queasy about this. I don't know if this is any different than a sulfur recovery unit where you're going to have a product at the end. Maybe you don't always have that product. Again, it depends on location. If you don't have any oil fields anywhere around the generation unit, it's not going to be feasible to put in a pipeline. I think that if you did it under Tier 2 and you looked at each individual aspect of it, I think you'd be fair to everybody.
Yeah, I think the one you're talking about was the steam methane recovery, and it was the byproduct with CO2 in that process, if I was recalling. I remember that went before here 3 years ago, 4 years ago. Was it?
I know it's not what Mr. Nassy is proposing, because he's just talking about the carbon capture. But one of the things that comes to mind is we're talking about the CO2 goes across the, outside the fence line of the plant. And if it's going to be sold as a product, you have to have an amine unit and compression. And which is other property that would be taxable
inside the fence line.
No, that's outside. Another outside the fence line. It's another company's sets up to do the CO2 cleanup. But in what he's also describing, you might have to do that anyway if you have a way to send the stuff before you sequester it, which means in some cases that equipment might end up being tax exempt under this program, and in some cases it would not. So that's just a can of worms that we're going to have to, in the future think about when this sort of thing starts happening. It doesn't really affect the carbon capture that's Mike talking about, but it's something else in the future that, if there's many of these, we may end up having to think about.
Yeah, I think in a chemical application and a refining complex application, there are different questions, right? Because carbon dioxide and the byproduct gases can actually be direct feedstocks, right? There are different issues, but I'm just trying to capture the simple-minded approach of you got a pollutant, it's regulated, you got capture equipment. And I'm sensitive to the fact that there are going to be off-site disposal and potentially partial use. Most of the projects that have been proposed have the ability to both dispose and use the CO2 downhole, and it's kind of unknown which one's going to be more based on the characteristics of the reservoir. The Canadian project is like that, for example, the Boundary Dam project. What I think would be a good solution is what I'm proposing, and I'll craft it for our next meeting, is let that determination about whether and to what extent people have success in marketing the product, let that be a decision about how we treat the pipeline and the injection network. They'll let it go reach back into the incentive we want to create, or the policy which the statute stands for, which is that if a regulation requires the control of a pollutant and somebody is installing technology to control that pollutant, it has been the longstanding tradition of this program that when that truly is pollution control equipment, or it's an equipment that's capturing, not necessarily process changes, but capturing a pollutant, we recognize it. And so if it's on site, that's what I'm getting at. And it's just a very slippery slope from a precedent standpoint to not do that, frankly, because of the things we've talked about with regard to other pollution control equipment. People do not go out and capture carbon dioxide because they want to make money. They capture carbon dioxide because the regs are heading toward the regulation of it, and by the time this recommendation hits, will be consummated. And what they do is they try to cover the costs as much as possible, and the costs are significant, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. They try to cover that with some kind of marketing technique. But anyway, so I've said enough, and I'll take more questions and certainly put it in writing and put a little one pager to support it in our next before our next meeting.
I was about to suggest that. I think we can probably get our heads around this a little more if you would put the project and the or the property and a description and also some rationale of why we're doing this. I would also add the fence line and not fence line might work and might be appropriate in this case, but keep in mind we have other items on the Tier 1 list that are not. Not as much in a fence line, for example, pipeline property, so that we might need to talk about that in a different way. All right. Thanks, Mike. Any other comments about carbon capture? Boyd.
Mike, one more, if I might. Talk about the capital investment for profitability, non-profitability. People are capturing carbon dioxide for pollution reasons and all that other. That large investment that was originally Sand Ridge in Pecos County, how does all, when you look at your memo and you think about that, would you mind telling us how that's taxed and what's going on out there?
You talking about gas cleanup operations?
I am.
Yeah. I will. I'll address that in the memo.
Thank you.
Bernie, thank you. All right. I suspect we'll talk about this quite a bit more when Mike prepares the email for. And please provide that to us, Mike, if you would. Sufficient time for us to think about it before our next meeting.
Will do.
All right. You guys want to go back to the top of the list? Not that we want to go through every item on here, but I generally want to ask. And again, the logic for this was to review the Tier 2 and the Tier 3 application statistics that were presented by TCEQ staff. And not necessarily that there wasn't a certain threshold of frequency of or number of applications, although they helped. But in some cases, they described it as this is pollution control. That's been their determination. So any comments on the
So road? Just a comment and a question. There's two items that involve storage tanks of hydrocarbons, and I would be very supportive of that because recent evidence from the hurricane is those who had geodesic domes or had better external roofs on their hydrocarbon storage units did a lot better than those that didn't. So I think we should be encouraging that. But my question is, and I was looking at the Texas regs on storage tanks, and maybe this is for TCEQ. So we don't, neither of these items, the fixed roof on tanks or the geodesic domes, are necessarily required. You don't have to do it, but it is an additional control that's helpful towards control of VOCs. Is that true?
So anything that we would approve as pollution control would need to be required by regulation. So where I've seen the geodesic domes come in is to reduce additional fugitive emissions. They're usually citing some sort of fugitive emission rule The one on fixture tank, I'd have to go back and look at which one we approved as a tier two. That can be tricky because you do need a roof on your tank. So whether or not it would need to be 100% on this table or some sort of incremental difference where you are putting a fixed roof versus a floating roof, I think I would need to wrap my mind around that one before immediately putting that on the tier one table as 100%. But there are requirements for seals on roofs. There are several that I know of state requirements relating to VOC storage tanks.
Okay, so I think I'm generally supportive, but I would like to get more information about linking it specifically to what's required. And on the other hand, if it's you've got to do something on your roof, and these are two ways to get there, I'd be supportive of that too, but I'd just like to know a little more about that.
No, weren't these two applications? This is Charles Allred. Weren't these two applications for fixed roofs or geodesic domes used in conjunction with floating roof?
I think you're right.
Meaning that would be sort of an exceeding. You're doing more than you need to do by adding this extra roof. Is that?
Yeah, I guess it's capturing anything that does make it past the float roof. But I guess you would also, maybe the qualification being you're meeting or exceeding your emission rate and your table for that particular emission point for VOC.
Thanks, Charles.
Yeah.
Are we thinking about that item a little more? Are we?
I'm sorry, what?
I was looking around the room to see if there was some additional thoughts before I...
Yeah, there's actually a good table in the rules that kind of says, depending on the size of the storage capacity, what you have to do in terms of the control requirements. So if you've got a larger tank, you're basically required to do more in terms of the roofs. So yeah, it may be actually tied
kind
to
of
the...
We're talking about fixed roofs in general, but I was just looking at the details of the two applications I'm looking at, and there was a float roof and a fixed roof or a geodesic dome. And if that's the criteria, that you got to have the float roof used in conjunction with, then that would make sense. Otherwise, if you don't, you just put a fixed roof with no float roof inside, then you get stormwater in your product.
This is Lloyd again. My assumption is that the geodesic dome roofs are being built to wind standards. Being in La Porte and having been down there for Ike and Harvey, and given that there's a depression in the Gulf now with a 30% chance of forming and coming into Corpus, to Cyrus's point, those of us on the ship channel would be supportive of whatever it took to get rigid structured roofs on top of the floating roofs.
Thanks, Lloyd. Any other comments?
My only comment is I may be misreading these two items on a sheet, but it ought to be the difference in cost of having a covered roof and not having it. It kind of looks like it's...
Yeah, which page were we talking about, Wayne?
Well, I guess it's just the roof that's being exempted, not the whole tank.
Correct.
And okay, I just, depending on how you read it, it's not necessarily clear to me.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of, it's the belts and suspenders. You've got an external float, and then you put a roof on top of it to capture any emissions that comes off, like a secondary containment.
Any other items we want to discuss? Maybe it'd be easier to just take this a page at a time. And I'll ask, since there are only seven pages. So any questions, discussion on page one? Any other discussions? Of course, that's where the geodesic dome roofs and the fixed roofs are.
These all have tier two on them. We're okay. It's to add to tier one. Then I hate to say it, I'm a little worried about the construction equipment. And the reason is so often you can have bulldozers or whatever earth-moving equipment, and you're using it for land reclamation. But when you're through with the land reclamation there and you move the equipment, and you might use it to remove overburden, and it's no longer land reclamation. My concern is it really needs to be looked at to make sure that that equipment won't change uses, or if it does, that the exemption is removed.
Yeah, but that happens with either a Tier 1 or a Tier 2. You have to look at the use of the equipment every time. So this is the construction type equipment which they use in reclamation, but it's been filed under a Tier 2 and been granted. This is just saying that since it's doing reclamation work and it does it every time, then you're moving it from a Tier 2 to a Tier 1 because it's the use of the equipment, not necessarily.
Well, I'm just concerned once something gets an exemption, it's hard to say, hey, it no longer qualifies.
Well, yeah, but that happens under a Tier 2 or a Tier 1. You'd have to look at the use every year to make sure that that reclamation project is in use versus the
okay.
Quarry is no longer in use.
All right. Any other items on page one? All right. We'll flip the page. Page two.
Just quick question on the reciprocating engines. So this is really about reducing NOx formation before it gets into the actual production process. It's not like a Herzig issue. It's no, okay. Because reciprocating engines are being now built for kind of fast acting natural gas systems all around the state, so they're going to be important.
I don't want to go too quickly through this. And pause for those on the phone. As long as your head's down, I will interpret that as you're thinking about it. I won't move on.
These block valves, is that all block valves or is it emergency shutdown valves?
We're looking to TCQ staff to answer that one.
Right. I think that those could have been used either way, but they had a remote actuator that would shut it down, kind of like an interlock system to prevent spills.
Okay. Is this for like pipelines, or is this because there's an awful lot of these valves in
production?
Yeah,
units. These the ones that I recall from the Tier 2 label were pipeline related, or they were so associated with drilling or pipelines. Yeah.
then
not in a production unit like you're thinking of, just a production interlock.
Then maybe if we put that tier one, we ought to point that to being
specific to pipelines.
And if you need to do that in another application, it could go to a tier two instead of tier one.
Will you turn your mic?
Yes, if you look at the proposed language.
Sorry, I'm not a speed reader.
And by the way, just because we move to the next page, I don't interpret that as your last chance to comment on this. I mean, we can still provide that later. But it is good to get an indication for the ones that are concerned. We need more time on this page. It's okay if we do. I'm seeing some thoughtful looks, so I'm saying this, yes.
Just when you get to page three, it's do not add.
Right.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
So of all the ones we collected data on, as you can see, you have the property, you have the apps that were filed, you had the percentage that was the use determination, and there's a justification or explanation behind the proposed language for moving it. And it goes all the way through, even on the next page where it says tentative or not to be added. There's a justification or proposed language. Of course, some of them have none, but it gives you kind of a description of the application of what was filed. Like if you look at the first one there, acoustic panels, a limited number of applications provide insufficient information to justify adding a tier one. There's not enough data out there to tell you one way or the other. So if there's not enough, then the answer is don't move it. So if you see, you've got one page of ads, which are, we've got information, and then the rest go through this. This is a draft. So if you want to add stuff to the list, add it to the list. That's the first pass.
And as I said earlier, we already have recommendations for one of those do not adds to be added to tier one, which is carbon capture. And as you'll see, some of these, the explanation for do not add is because it's duplicative. It's already on tier one. Good to see LaPorte listed on here. And I realize I only sent this out Wednesday, so you haven't had a tremendous amount of time to review this. I think put staff on the spot. Any concerns or any things that are we're showing do not add tentatively anything that you reviewed that you think should be on the list, or vice versa. Anything we're suggesting to add that you have concerns
it
about?
Says do not add. Yeah, I know. but they've already given some.
I probably put you on the spot too much. We can wait till later if you want.
What is the original amendment say?
Any other comments from the phone?
I'm here.
All right. Some of us are still reviewing in the room, and that's okay. Again, we prefer a good vetting of these items, so if you have any concerns or want further research or whatever, we can ask for that. And I'll remind those of you in the audience, you're welcome to comment.
Question. So one of the things on the second page added are these submerged fill pipes, but there's only been one application. Has there only been one application because this is some sort of new requirement, or people just aren't doing this? Or
I think a lot of people just aren't identifying it. So a lot of times what they do is they put in a submerged fill pipe in a tank, and they put it down low in the tank to keep splash down. Because splash causes VOCs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty self-evident. They're extending the pipe down to the bottom of the tank to reduce turbulence.
This would be in sort of a refinery application? So this isn't the storage tank.
It would be any storage tank.
Any storage tank.
Could use that. And there are I know that the state 115 rules have requirements for submerged fill for some applications.
Well, this says 116. That's why I was confused. It's not I thought it'd be in the one, at least the justification says 116.
They might have just pointed to a permit requirement as opposed to a 115 rule requirement.
Okay.
We only pulled these. These were only for the past. I would have to go back and look how many there have been since the beginning of the program. This is only the past 5 years, I think. Goes back to 2014 of data.
Okay, so they're pointing back to just a general emission, probably, emission limit, as opposed to the what's required in the tank, maybe.
But it's not a new technology, I wouldn't say. It's essentially part of the configuration of the tank and where material enters the tank.
Thanks.
Any other discussion on page 2 or any other page?
That's like a water heater.
Okay.
It's like a water heater. The water goes to the bottom of the tank to fill it.
Yeah, and just on that same note, then I would ask that we identify, because that 116.11 just points to a general permit thing saying you're not going to pollute. So it'd be better to tie it back to maybe where in 115 that requirement would be. More specificity on the actual device.
All right. Other comments?
Yeah, this is Charles Allred. I know that submerged fill is considered best achievable control technology for chemical drum filling. And I think there's a, under 115.222 of 30 tag, does refer to a submerged fill requirement related to gasoline storage.
Charles, would you repeat that reg, please?
30-115.222.
Okay, thanks. Sarge might want to say that into the mic.
he's correct. It says in 115.222.1, the containers are equipped with a submerged fill pipe as defined in 101 of this title, blah, blah, blah. So it's saying for these, for the filling of gasoline storage vessels, at least for this type of product, you're supposed to have, you're supposed to meet that condition.
Okay. Some are still reviewing. Some seem to be okay to take this for advisement later on.
If I can add, when looking at all these were just looked at on the merits of the applications that were in place, and then the proposed language and justifications were based on that. It wasn't looked at it from any standpoint, from a monetary standpoint or anything of that nature, but just the applications themselves. So that's why a lot of work went into looking at all this and trying to come up with proposed language. So please look it over.
Hey, Greg, on page 2, the last one, I just don't know what that is, so enlighten me.
Sealless pumps?
Why 70?
That was just on the application, I think.
Oh, is it? Okay, it just...
Yeah. That's just these are just excerpts from the applications themselves, property descriptions.
If you look at the Tier 2 and Tier 3 data that we got from TCU, I think they would just copy and paste it in. Correct, Greg? Okay. Just so you have an indication of which ones that were reviewed.
And since these pumps don't have seals, they don't leak, is that they're designed to do that without seals? Is that I'm not familiar with these sealless pumps. Okay,
we're starting to see those in industry, the sealless pumps, and they're a lot more expensive, and they're actually better. So as you can see in this one application, 70 sealless pumps. So technology.
So and we're the incremental cost. I have
Charles again. If it helps, once again on the submerged fill, there is an actual chart under 115.112A1 that has a control requirement for submerged fill.
Charles, you had me at hello.
Okay. Well, I just want to throw that at that. But it does actually specify certain sizes of tanks and what you require. And that's for pretty much any VOC other than crude oil. So it's wide application.
Thanks, Charles. Anything else? Any other comments on this? Any comments from the audience? Our non-members on the phone. Trying to allow adequate opportunity for input. All right. It seems the next steps are, I think, our to-do items are for Mike Nassy to provide us with a memo or a one-pager on the carbon capture, both the property and the description and the rationale of why he believes it should be added to Tier 1. And any other items that I'm... Yeah, it seemed like there was one more.
This is just a question. On our existing Tier 1 list, item A60, fugitive emission monitors... it says organic vapor analyzers used to discover leaking piping components. We cover any kind of equipment you use to find fugitive emissions, whether it's for pipes or oil. I'm thinking of the leak detection cameras. Those are covered, right, under Tier 1? Yeah. It's not specific to leaking piping. It's specific to finding fugitive emissions. Okay.
Right. Number A64 includes portable monitors like the optical gas imaging.
Oh, okay. You're talking about. Okay. I wanted to make sure we were covering that since I'm advocating that people use it.
Sure.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Iris. So I will take it, since I think everyone is here except Don Lee, and by the way, that's correction, he is absent. I take it that we can move forward with this, or we're getting closer to a recommendation for this draft, with the exception of carbon capture, to be added, or potentially to be added. There doesn't seem to be a major issue with the other items on the list.
Yeah, and just as I said, on actually both those items, submerged fill pipes, and even the next one, the incremental cost difference between CO-less pumps, having specific references to...
Okay, right.
Because again, that I think that 116, 115C is just sort of generally... control pollution. I don't know if it's specific to CO-less pumps, but the more you can tie it to, I think it helps.
All right. So, Cyrus, just to clarify, you're referring to the justification and explanation, but we also have the proposed language. So you're saying we need to revise the proposed language in the far right?
No, it was more on the justification, what regulations you're meeting.
Okay. Okay. And we will plan to again put these on the next committee's agenda to give people another chance at this. If that's okay with the group, or let me back up and ask, well, what's the pleasure of the committee?
I think what you're suggesting, we go back and review it, and when we come back at the next meeting, vote on it.
Okay. Any other comments? Others concur with that?
Thanks for all the work folks put into this. This is a good list.
Okay. Okay. We will plan to do that. All right. Any other items on, any other discussion on item 3 for the agenda?
Yeah.
One more chance, those on the phone. All right, we'll go to item number four. Any old business we need to discuss? Any new business?
And can staff remind us, sorry, can staff remind us when that annual report, when do those annual reports come out, where you review the, now that Ron's, I know Ron's the one who used to, don't we require you guys to do an annual report, or isn't that the rules?
I have to double check. It should be, the 2017 one should be posted.
Okay.
I know Ron worked on that before he left.
Oh, okay. I just haven't looked.
But I'll double check, and make, if it's not up there, I'll make sure it is.
And you're referring to TCEQ's annual report, not our committee's annual report. Okay. Yeah, right. Okay.
Right. It should be available, but I'll double check that.
Well, one other piece of news. I've told some of you, but you all haven't heard. At the end of the year, I retire. I'll still make the meeting in December, but after that, you won't be seeing me here. So,
not even to heckle?
Well, I might. I might come and heckle.
That was being lighthearted.
You can call in.
Yeah. Well, we wish you well, Wayne. All right. One other bit of new business, and I want to be very factual and not go too far, but there have been some changes, of course, in the TCEQ staff, commissioners. Do you guys want to update us on that? We've seen the news releases, but if you just want to give us a brief update there. And if you're uncomfortable with it, I don't want you to misspeak. So I know you might be concerned about that. Yeah, true.
Okay, recently we've had changes down the hall. So we have Chairman Shaw retired. He was the chairman for quite some time. So the new chairman is Commissioner Nearman. And we also have one new commissioner, Commissioner Lindley. And then former Commissioner Toby Baker is now the executive director. I think those are all the... I'm looking around. Are those all? Oh, okay. And also specific to the program, our section manager, Donna Huff, was promoted, and she's now the air quality division director. So currently we have an interim section manager at Stephanie McMurray over here. So we're waiting to see who our new section manager will be.
Thank you. Glad I asked. I didn't know the last part of that.
Okay.
Only saw the...
Would you like to introduce any new additions to the tax relief staff that's reviewing applications?
Yeah, I think we've done that. Go ahead.
Sure, we've done that. As y'all know, Ron Hatler retired a couple of months ago. Kelly McKenzie came on to our staff, is reviewing. She's over here if you want to meet her and didn't get to meet her last meeting. And then Elizabeth Sartain is also doing reviews. So we have one vacant position right now.
I did find that the annual report did go up February 26th of 2018. Sorry, I just hadn't seen it, but Ron apparently got it done before he left.
Okay. Thanks, Shelley. Any other comments? Any other old business? I don't have it in front of me, but our next meeting is December. I should have that. Anyway, it's on the TCEQ's website. So you're always welcome to call me or, of course, talk to other members about any of these issues. And we will proceed. And, again, as I said, put the Tier 1 recommendation, the draft recommendation. I will consider that going through one vetting, and we will have the next version, which will primarily have the carbon capture on it, likely. Or maybe I shouldn't say likely. That's let me just kick it to Mike Nassy. He's preparing that. So... Any other comments? All right. Do you hear a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second to adjourn. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. All right. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.